Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, our personal tribute to Jesuit Cardinal Adam Kozlowski. Spotlight on Christian-Hindu dialogue and telling of Roman coins with our popular Latin lover. I'd like to begin by taking you to Zambia, where sadly Cardinal Adam Kozlowski, Archbishop Emeritus of Lusaka, died on September 28th at the age of 96. His funeral took place on Friday, October the 5th in Zambia, where this Jesuit had been working for over half a century, despite being, as his surname indicates, Polish-born. Ordained in 1937, he was one of five Jesuits who survived Nazi concentration camps during World War II, in his case Auschwitz and Dachau. Yet shortly after liberation in 1945, he was sent to Africa. And in 1959, when Lusaka was raised to the status of an archdiocese, he became the first archbishop there, only to resign from that post in 1969, requesting a native African take over. In a message of condolence addressed to the current Archbishop of Lusaka, Telesphore Mpundu, Pope Benedict XVI described Cardinal Kozlowski as a noble soul who had committed himself to selfless years of zealous episcopal and missionary service. The Cardinal had often visited us in our studios here at Vatican Radio. In a tribute to him, we'd like to share with you excerpts from an exclusive interview dating back to 1998, when he came to Rome to be created cardinal. We began by asking him what had brought a Polish Jesuit to Africa. He replied very simply, Jesuit obedience. Let's listen.
Jesuit obedience. I did not want to go to Africa. You see, I came out from the concentration camps, 5.5 years, so the dream was going back home. But then when I was asked to go to Northern Rhodesia, although I was told they would not give me a strict order, I did go not with heavy heart. And then afterwards I had no time to think whether I like it or not, because there was so much work to be done. When I came there in 1946, that was the Prefecture Apostolic of Lusaka. I was the 16th priest in this whole area. So we had plenty of work. I immediately was put into work without any course preparation, because there was no possibility in 46 after the war. So I was thrown into work and I grew into it.
As Cardinal Kozlowski mentioned the concentration camps himself, we asked if his life as a missionary in faraway Africa had helped heal some of the scars of those 5.5 years of extreme suffering under the Nazi imprisonment. Once again, he stressed how his life in Africa was so busy that he had no time to think about the past. A pass he eventually had to publicly face 50 years after he'd first walked to freedom.
It's 1995. That was the 50th anniversary of the liberation of the camp. And I was invited by Cardinal Vetter to concelebrate a mass with him in the former concentration camp in Dachau. And afterwards, here in Rome, they asked me my most vivid recollections from the camp. I said there were so many that difficult to say. But then I said, you know, I think so often about the things when I laughed. And they were surprised about it. And I said, yes, what did you laugh about? I said, how we treated these people, you know, who were there. Well, there were hard times, but we had also a laugh when we did something which was not allowed and when we got away with it. For example, you see, I noticed very soon, as I came, I watched, when they beat you, well, this man beat you, and he was happy and satisfied when you fell down. So I did him the pleasure immediately, after the first day. I was not so weak, but I did it. And then I was beaten less. He was satisfied that I fell the second time and then left me alone. So that was also, you know, afterwards, a reason to laugh. Yeah. Then the other things, you see, I was asked once in Poland when I went first time after 31 years, and I was asked, how did I survive this? And without thought, I said, you know, I was cheating, stealing, and not going to confession. I should have said not confessing it. Yeah, but that is how we are living, and you had to do it for yourself and for the others.
As we've just heard, Father Adam did not leave the concentration camp a bitter man. With characteristic sense of humour, he would make light of his suffering there, telling people it was the best training he ever received, adding, wryly, better than the Jesuits. It seems he was unable to hate.
They asked me, did you hate? I said, I was unable to hate. I remember that. And in concrete conditions, I had to know. I was afraid of them, but not hating them. I always prayed when I was, there were somewhere, you know, after me, they would have finished me off. I prayed only, God, if you want, you can save me in this situation. And always it happened. Either I was transferred to another group, or he was transferred. One of the SS was sent to the front. Once only, a prisoner who was a German communist, he beat me very badly, you know. I prayed also this. He died. I didn't ask for his death. But I believe in the power of prayer. But not, you know, that God gives us always what we want. I believed, you see, well, even if I die, I believe that God loves us.
Cardinal Adam Kozłowski received many prestigious awards during his lifetime, from Africa to Poland, but also to France, where he was even awarded the Légion d'Honneur. Among the motivations for this last order were, quote, "Your life is an extraordinary resume of trials and hopes of Europeans in the 20th century. You have been a political prisoner, a deportee, a refugee, a stateless person, a priest, an educator, a prince of the Roman Catholic Church. You're out of the ordinary destiny. Your humanity, your moral authority, make you a good man, a man that the Republic of France, even if you did not render service to it, wanted to honour." A fitting tribute indeed to Cardinal Adam Kozłowski, a man who often spoke of himself as a simple priest from the African bush, and whose funeral, as we said earlier, took place in Lusaka on Friday, October the 5th. And now it's time to leave Africa behind us, and in a sense Poland as well, and focus on India and a good news story. A story of dialogue. dialogue between Christians and Hindus was the focus of a meeting which took place in the Italian city of Florence this past month. Among the Christians attending was Roberto Catalano of the Focolari Catholic Lay Movement, who's among those engaged in ongoing dialogue with Hindus in India itself, where he's been living together with others from this movement since 1980. A dialogue, he claims, between two faiths that have been interacting for centuries.
Hinduism and Christianity are not dialoguing only recently. It is an interaction which is going on for centuries.
But for Catholics in particular, Roberto Catalano goes on to say, greater attention was paid to this dialogue at the time of the Second Vatican Council, first under the pontificate of John XXIII and then Paul VI.
For us Christians, especially Catholics, after the Second Vatican Council, there had been an opening up of a new dimension. The respect for the diversity of the other religions has grown immensely, and this has favored also a mutual dimension in dialogue, which previously was perceived sometimes more as a threat rather than a dialogue approach. I must say that we as a Focolare, we are not the only Christian organization committed in dialogue in India. The church in India is very much committed at the level of dialogue. Our experience of dialogue is a dialogue of life, which started with the Shanti Ashram within the folds of the World Conference for Religions and Peace, a constructive dialogue that developed in the last 6 years through roundtables between the Sabodaya movement and the Focolare movement on different religious aspects like the idea of God, the will of God, the commandment of love, the golden rule, but also, let's say, more secular topics like politics, economics, ecology, education, and also through social actions, common enterprises in social upliftment on the territory around Coimbatore, in artistic expressions, and also in exchange of youth between the metropolitan areas, Bombay and Bangalore, and the rural areas of Tamil Nadu. And this has created a great integration among these youth. They are small groups so far, but a very promising experiment because it creates a very constructive integration at the human, national, religious, and social level. So let's say we can say that these years have been a lab, a testing phase, and a launching pad now for new enterprises, new programs, and new possibilities to open up more and more in dialogue with each other.
Clearly, Roberto Catalano feels there are further grounds for breathing new life into this dialogue between the two faiths. But how does the Hindu representative attending this meeting view this dialogue?
One great expression of interfaith cooperation is the ability to talk to one another. Of course, conversations happen anyway, but if these conversations are conscious efforts, like what we say in the form of dialogue, I think there is also a greater commitment to understand one another.
She's Vinu Aram, daughter of the founder and director of the Gandhian-inspired Shanti Ashram, which has been closely working with the Focolare movement ever since 2001, when this ashram awarded the founder of the Focolare movement, Chiara Lubich, the prize Defender of Peace. It was precisely this ashram which Vinu Aram represented at this recent meeting in Florence, together with 20 or so other Hindu academics. Naturally, the Gandhian inspiration was reflected on this occasion in the theme of the meeting. Journeying towards unity of humanity, Christian and Gandhian proposals.
And from the Gandhian movement, we've always been open to these platforms of dialogue so that we not only understand one another better, but I think that we have to go a step further, is to build on this understanding action that will be positive and constructive for our societies. In that way, our interaction with Christian family, particularly the Focolare movement, has a great relevance because I think we share one thing in common, and that is we look at our spiritual motivations as launching pads for our social action. And with this commonality, we have begun dialogue starting from our leaders, but I think it has also become a dialogue of life and dialogue of people, young people, academicians, artists, workers, each bringing with them their richness, their perspectives on life. And I think while academicians can use it in shaping and information of minds as they go in to become responsible citizens and professionals, young people, for young people, when we start early with them, it is giving them a whole new way of looking at life. And I think though small it may be, these are important contributions that we give as active and responsible citizens for our whole world.
Mahatma Gandhi is well known in our Western world. Books and films have relayed to us his legacy of non-violence. Who hasn't heard of his nationwide peaceful campaigns for the alleviation of poverty, for brotherhood among religions and ethnicities, for an end to untouchability and caste discrimination, for the economic self-sufficiency of the nation and for the independence of India from foreign domination? A legacy, that of Gandhi, recently highlighted in June 2007, when the United Nations General Assembly unanimously adopted a resolution declaring October the 2nd, the date of his birth, as International Day of Nonviolence. Just one example of how Gandhi's prophetic vision is still alive in our Western democracies today. But what about the Indians themselves? How do they view the legacy of this man they commonly refer to as the father of their nation? Mahatma Gandhi, whose name means great soul. That's what we asked Vinu Aram.
To the question of how alive the Gandhian idea is today, I think the short answer is it is very much alive. But it is alive in different spaces. I think it is alive within the Gandhian movement, people who have committed themselves to the Gandhian vision of Sarvodaya. It is alive in our polity, in our democratic structures. It is alive in our academic institutions. It is definitely alive in the social sphere, where people still relate to Gandhiji's vision of commitment to the development of the society in tandem with personal development. So I think the vision and dream of Mahatma Gandhi is still alive.
Gandhi died in 1948, well over half a century ago. Yet his vision then was undoubtedly prophetic in many areas of interest, from political to social. Vinu Aram develops this idea for us.
Mahatma Gandhi's greatest gift to the world is one that is prophetic. Even in the early part of the 20th century, he spoke of issues that had a significance in different parts of the world. The issue of social justice, for example, whether it was the caste system in India or colonialism, all of these structures have, all of these issues have in them inherently an element of justice. He also spoke about self-confidence when he spoke, for example, of the Swadeshi movement within India. He spoke about the richness that each culture, each religion, each region of the world had to offer. And he, I think, could see that the world would come closer and closer, but coming to closer also meant being aware of the diversity and celebrating that diversity. I think the other great contribution of Mahatma Gandhi was his life itself, where he was honest about the struggles that he had gone through individually, but with also people with whom he worked, whether it was for political independence or for social justice or for interreligious harmony. And I think this is a great gift to the world, because sometimes we are shy of sharing our struggles. We are much more willing to share our successes. And as we stand in the beginning of the 21st century, I think this gift of being able to share our struggles is very relevant, whether we speak of the challenges that countries face in dealing with internal issues, also with global issues like global warming or, for example, regional wars or, for example, HIV/AIDS. I think this, the human struggle for a peaceful world and the ability to share this with more and more people is a gift that Gandhiji gave the world.
My thanks there go to Vinu Aram of the Gandhian-inspired Shanti Ashram and to Ricardo Catalano of the Focolari Catholic Lay Movement. My thanks to go to my Italian colleague Adriana Mazzotti for making this program possible. Meanwhile, I'd like to share with you the words of one of the popes of the 20th century, Paul VI, when he met in Bombay with representatives of non-Christian religions. It was the 3rd of December 1964. And to those present, Christians and non-Christians alike, the Pope highlighted how we should live our lives as children of God. Are we not all one, he said, in this struggle for a better world?
Are we not all one in this struggle for a better world?
In an effort to make available to all people those goods which are needed to fulfill their human destiny and to live lives worthy of the children of God.
Lives worthy of the children of God.
We must come close together, not only through modern means of communication, the first pilgrim pope stressed, specifying through press and through radio, through steamships and jet planes.
Through press and radio, through steamships and jet planes.
We must come together with our hearts in mutual understanding, esteem and love. We must not meet merely as tourists, but as pilgrims who set out to find God, not in buildings of stone, but in human hearts. We must begin to work together to build the human future of the human race. We must find concrete and practical ways of organization and cooperation so that all resources be pooled and all efforts united towards achieving a true communion among all nations. Such a union cannot be built on a universal terror of fear or mutual destruction. It must be built on the common love that embraces all and has its roots in God, who is love. True love, Paul VI insisted, must be renewed in our midst and must become the inspiring force of all our efforts. We need peace and stability, food, clothing, and housing for millions, honesty and devotion, all efforts animated by true love.
Esteem and love.
And finally, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Father Reginald Foster. Join us on Rome's Capitoline Hill and watch the change of pace. It's the temple of Juno Moneta, right? It's the home of the early Roman mint.
Well, after the Samnite Wars, the Romans didn't have coins. So they were bartering, and there was a lot of confusion. So they decided to stamp their coins.
So what did they stamp on them?
Senatus Populusque Romanus,
yes.
Which means the Roman Senate and people. In Latin we say the Roman Senate, people, and. Well, anyway, and so they decided that Juno Moneta, you see, would admonish them, tell them, how much bronze and silver and gold to put in these coins. And watch this whole process, because that was her story. Moneta, admonisher. Juno, the admonisher. She would give judgments. So there was always a female god there, goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you get monetary policy, because she admonished people about the coins. No one knows that story at all.
Of course, Roman coins tell us a lot about Roman history, don't they?
Oh, heavens. And sometimes you have a face there and behind you see figures, you know, like temples and things like that. So we can reconstruct the Roman Forum on the basis of the figures we see on the coins. Because the emperor is sitting in this corner, that corner, this thing, and behind him you see temples and columns and different things. It's very important.
Take a battle site like the disaster of Varus, for example, in Germany. Presumably the legionaries who died there, they left some coins on the ground and they were found afterwards. So they're like archaeological
proof. They're still finding things all over the place.
Mm-hmm. At the time of the Roman Empire, they had depictions of the empress on the coin. And the ladies in the faraway provinces used to imitate the empress's hairstyle.
Mm-hmm.
And is that true?
Well, certainly.
And we talk about the euro now, whereas the Roman coin, the moneta,
It didn't actually have a name to it, did it? It was just a moneta.
Well, I mean, the divisions, what, a tenth of a coin was this, and a hundredth was this, and three coins was that. They had different names for the denominations, but in general...
But I mean, it wasn't a lira or a franc or...
No, they didn't have that.
So they had these coins, which were the Roman coins, all over the empire, from Egypt to Africa to Germany.
Oh, yeah, certainly, anyway, down to, yeah, certainly to Pakistan.
So Rome and its coins were really a model.
Well, yeah, certainly. And they said, this is the emperor that we have their hairdos with their curly hair a little later, like Vespasian and stuff. And they used to imitate the hairdos of the empresses.
They wouldn't have had Egypt depicted on a Roman coin.
Well, yes, they would, in the sense that if they had like Augustus's province was Egypt. So we would have coins of Augustus on one side as Augustus. But who knows, a Sphinx or maybe a pyramid on the other side saying that Egypt belonged to Augustus. We would. It wouldn't be a Roman Egyptian coin. It would be a celebration of Augustus's possession of Egypt.
So basically, Rome represented a seductive model of civilization at the time, no?
Well, yeah, everyone...
How do you say that in Latin? So
these are some of your concepts, but there's no problem. Exemplar exhibebat qua humanitatis.
Humanitatis meaning?
Humaneness or civilization. Quod alio seducebat, which was seducing other people.
Seducebat is seducing.
Was seducing other people.
Mm-hmm. And nothing escaped this influence.
Vim eos nil fugiebat.
I heard that even the statue of Horus in Egypt sported a legionary's head at one point.
Of Horus?
Horus.
Oh, Horus, a Horus of the hours there. Oh, yeah, maybe, yeah. Of course, the Romans were down there. Yeah, that's possible.
The Latins took over everything at the time, didn't they?
Yeah, kind of like boorish farmers.
Yeah, but they had their act together. How do you say that? Farmers had their act together. How do you say that in Latin?
Rem suam bene agebant. Rem suam bene agebant. They were doing their thing well.
Boorish farmers?
Well, boorish farmers are agricole rudes.
That's easy enough.
Rustici. I mean, they came in there, they didn't have anything, and they would tear apart things and smash things down, which were priceless because they were stupid.
How do you say priceless?
Yeah, sine prezio. The one guy in Corinth, the famous thing, the Flamininus in Corinth, some guy came along and said, look at this statue, and it's worth like $2 million. And this stupid Roman said, have it destroyed. And some guy said, what? And they had it in pieces. And he said, why? He said, well, there must be something magical about it. Something spooky, something it's possessed, it's diabolical because of such a price. And the man, the Greek said, no, the price was just because it was beautiful, because it was worth $2 million. But the stupid Roman didn't understand this.
You've been listening to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Laudetur Jesus Christus.